The House will come to order if members can take their seats.
This budget is a huge job maker, and the number one solution to economic insecurity is a job.
Hungry children can't learn, and it's our responsibility to try to help.
Equality and opportunity.
I believe most people are here because they want to do some good.
You can tell by that music and those voices that you've found a brand new episode of Capital Ideas, the long-running podcast series from the Washington State House Democratic Caucus. It's so long-running, in fact, that this first episode of the new year kicks off season 17. If you've been around the whole time, welcome back. And if you're new here, this is the best place there is to hear members of the Democratic majority in the Washington State House sit down at the Capitol and talk about ideas. Today, those ideas belong to Spokane Representative Tim Ormsby. As chair of the Appropriations Committee, Tim is the lead writer of the House version of the state's operating budget. Since this is an odd-numbered year, we're in what they refer to around here as a long session. It's 105 days compared to the 60-day sprint in even-numbered years. It's longer because that's when the state's three big biennial budgets, operating, transportation, and capital, are written. That was an understandably time-consuming task, even in the state's tender years, and today it's amazing they can finish on time. But that's what they've managed to do for several years now, and much of that coincides with Tim sitting in that big chair. We recorded this in Olympia on Friday, January 10th, 3 days before the official opening of the 2025 legislative session, and here it is. Hi, Tim. Welcome back to Capital Ideas, first one of the 2025 legislative session.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Dan. Very good to be with you.
I think we're going to talk about a whole lot of things today, and many of them, not surprisingly, are going to be budget-related since you are chair of the House Appropriations Committee. I'm not going to ask you about what's going to be in the budget because it's a little premature on that, but I do want to talk about the process because I think that that's going to be almost as interesting this year as what ends up in the final document.
This will be a slightly different year. What we have done in the past, and we have just off of 12 years with the current governor, we would generally get the governor's budget proposal that we would use as a template for agencies. We would hear from analysts about the justification of the agency's decision package, the accuracy of the information, because the information is constantly changing. And the governor has the disadvantage of having a very narrow window of time between the time the latest revenue forecast comes out and until the time that he is required to submit his proposal to the legislature for review. And we begin with that proposal as our template, as our starting point.
The Department of Transportation, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, et cetera, and they all come up with their wish list for the coming 2 years, and they present it to the governor. The governor vets it, puts it in his or her budget, and you get it.
And there's one exception to that. The court budget is not vetted by the executive branch because it is a co-equal branch of government, and the executive branch does not have constitutional authority to review another branch of government. The legislature, though, does have the responsibility of funding state government, so the purse strings component of the legislature's responsibility. So we do the unpacking and the vetting and verifying of the court budget just to apply the same principles to that as we do elsewhere.
So they don't just get what they want necessarily. You guys get to decide.
Yes. Again, there is constantly new information coming out. It's like, well, the Administrative Office of the Courts, which the Supreme Court is kind of generally included in, have revised their interpretation of this, that, or the other thing, and here is their new fiscal note for this particular part of the Supreme Court's budget or the District Court budget or Superior Court, et cetera. So we're constantly getting new information, and we will make a first pass through the entire governor's proposal. We do that in a bipartisan fashion with our Republican colleagues. It's a nonpartisan analysis of the governor's budget. The House and Senate nonpartisan staff agree on what is policy level, meaning it's a new idea or an idea that needs to pass the legislature, versus a maintenance level appropriation, which is kind of set. It's based on eligibility. Let's just take a low-income health care, or the state's Medicaid plan is based, the expenditures there are based on the federal match that we get. It's based on the eligibility under state law of individuals, based on a number of things. And after the House and Senate nonpartisan staff agree, we will get what we call the ledge view of the governor's budget. All the political narratives are removed. All of this is just a sanitary document based on nonpartisan evaluation that is agreed to between the House and Senate.
One thing that's different this year is that the governor's budget that you've got before you now was proposed by the outgoing governor, who has got, I think, 4 days left in his term as governor. Then there's going to be a new governor. Governor Ferguson is going to present us with a new proposal. It may be similar to what Governor Inslee put forth. It may be totally different. But in any case, how much are you paying attention to Governor Inslee's budget proposal is my question.
Yeah, no, it's the most scrubbed document that we have. Now, Governor-elect Ferguson, who will be sworn in on January 13th, being as that today is January 10th, still a few days. It is unusual when we started out the conversation. This is a little bit of a different year because of the dynamic you just described with outgoing Governor Inslee and incoming Governor Ferguson. We don't expect to see a budget document from Governor Ferguson. We did get a several-page narrative from him very recently that talked about his priorities and his guiding principles. Basically, it's a document, it's a narrative, so it's not a balance sheet, it doesn't look like Governor Inslee's budget. Governor Inslee's, even though he's the outgoing governor, that document will become the one we use because it is formatted in the way that we also structure our budgets, and that's what nonpartisan staff scramble to do between mid-December, when the governor's proposal is released, and the beginning of the legislative session.
And just to be redundant, when you say that's the document that we will use, that means you will look at that and use that as a springboard.
Yes.
To come up with your own proposal.
Correct.
The Senate is going to have their own proposal.
We do it virtually simultaneously, so there is no, let's see what the Senate did and change ours. No, they come out virtually at the same time on a Sunday or a Monday or a Tuesday, boom, boom, right in a row. So we will release our respective perspectives on the Washington State operating budget at a very similar time. And then each chamber is responsible for hearing that budget, voting the budget out of committee with any amendments and changes that happen in committee. And then it will go to the floor as the House Appropriations proposal to the chamber. And it will be debated and passed eventually. That will be our negotiating document, our conference document.
And the same thing is going on in the Senate with their document.
Exactly. And then we will each have our as-passed floor. You will hear that phrase, use as-passed floor budgets. Then we will begin negotiating in earnest over the differences between those proposals. Now, we do intend to spend a good deal of time, or as much time as we possibly can, given everyone's busy schedule, to confer with our Senate colleagues and consult with them on an ongoing basis. We will certainly hold true to our House Democratic values, and the Senate will do likewise. But we end up having to reconcile. Often, we've had over 2,000 differences in budgets in the past, and you've got to reconcile all those in a very short period of time. That's called the conference. The negotiating period during conference is very busy with very long hours and sometimes short tempers even.
Let me ask a question. I'm somebody out who lives in Washington State. I don't follow the legislature because I've got a life and I've got a job and I've got a family. And I look over here to Olympia and I see that the Democrats are in charge of the Senate and the Democrats are in charge of the House. Why are there any differences between those two budgets? It's a naive question, but it's one that I think a lot of people would have on their minds.
I think that is legitimate. That's a legitimate question, and I think we do tend to simplify. But let's remember, these are human beings. So, you know, even identical twins have differences, right? And it is not just that we all carry the Democratic mantle. There are cultural differences between the chambers. There are twice as many House members as there are Senate members. We have several more committees to divvy up the responsibility. And with twice as many members, you have the ability to dig a little deeper. And we utilize that to inform ourselves. And the Senate has a slightly different process because they have just as many issues and just as many challenges with only half the number of members to deal with them. Everybody, I would have to say from my standpoint, everyone's singing from the same song sheet, but have different versions of what it should sound like. So it's like doing a cover of a Smokey Robinson tune. It's not going to sound the same way the Smokey sang it.
Let me ask you another question that I think will be asked by some people, particularly people who hear the rhetoric from the minority party. One of the roles of the minority party is basically just to stir up trouble. And part of that trouble now is that what we're hearing is, hey, we've got $4 billion in reserves. What's the problem?
We need to keep reserves. Because the reserves are what keeps Washington State's credit rating and bond rating as good as they are. And that's important to Washington State because we can save over the course of time hundreds of millions of dollars in financing costs because we're a good risk. And a good risk to the bond houses and the investment banks, which are the ones that provide this credit rating that other entities use. One thing that they like to see is that our pension is well-funded, which it is very well-funded. And they like to see that in the case of emergency, break glass reserve fund is available for use. And so we have reserves, but we don't know how the budget is going to shake out, but we need to maintain a certain level of reserves to make sure that we're not making our credit holders, our bond holders, nervous about the state's ability to pay them back. And I would just say that our bond payments is the first money out the door. When you say you're giving the full faith and credit of the Washington state government to pay for this, that means you pay that bill first. So I am not a financial wizard, and I'm not certain about all this, and I'm not necessarily believe that all of it is necessary, but I do know that we are stuck with the system that we have, and if we want cheaper financing rates, we're going to have to conform.
So the fact that we have got somewhat of a budget deficit as things stand at this moment,
correct?
It's not as simple as saying, well, let's just take some money out of the savings account, then we won't have a budget deficit.
Yeah, and we still would. We still would have a budget deficit, and so that would be... a little bit of the problem with that is you can only use that money once, then it's gone. So if it's not being replenished, what are you going to use next time? So don't want to eat your seed corn here. You don't want to, eat over the winter what you need to plant next spring so you can eat the following year. So we have to be careful, and it is a constant monitoring of that process and a constant check back on what that does to our fiscal position, our financial position, that we're putting the state and its residents in.
Former Speaker Frank Chop used to say, and I don't think he made this up himself, but he used to say frequently that a budget is a moral document. What does that mean to you? I know that we've got any number of priorities to deal with as a state government, housing, mental health, education. And that goes all the way down to early childhood education and childcare, up to somebody who's in a PhD program. There are food banks to help out. There's a little problem with the climate. How are you going to prioritize these things when you're drawing up the House version of the operating budget?
We do it collectively. So there are a lot of touch points. We have a large budget team, including the majority leader, the three appropriations vice chairs, two-partisan staff, and an entire classroom of nonpartisan fiscal analysts that do the detective work on all of those agencies' budgets, scrub them, ask difficult questions, get to the bottom of it. They're, we've been working together as a team now for several years, so they understand what we're generally looking for and what we prioritize. We will go through every section of the budget probably at least three times, often seven, not everything seven times, but the stickier stuff, the stuff that's more challenging and difficult, the ones that involve the most money or that require the most unpacking and discerning of, those can take a while, but we have a limited amount of time. We've got to adhere to the cutoff calendar, which is a very rigid document that if you're going to get out when the legislature is supposed to adjourn, you've got to hit these marks. You've got to be this far on this date and this far on that date, and you just have to keep grinding and driving to get to that point where you've made all the decisions that need to be made and you can present it as a finished budget.
So the people you just named are people who, they kind of specialize in coming up with the budget. But really, there are 98 members of the House. How wide of a net do you cast when you're seeking input? How about Republicans? Yeah. How much do you talk to the minority party when you're drawing up a budget that we already know they're going to vote against?
Yeah, well, and so I think, you know, each year is dynamic. In three successive years, we have had three different Republican leads on the Appropriations Committee. Each lead in each year is going to be different, regardless of the committee. I work closely with my Republican counterpart on scheduling. For example, scheduling the nonpartisan briefing of Governor Inslee's budget, we will do that jointly so that all members, they would get the same presentation whether we were in the room or not. We would get the same presentation whether they were in the room or not. But by doing it together, it's more efficient, saves staff time, and they can go off and do their important work when they're not taking additional time to do briefings. We will do those together. We'll go through the entirety by group, not every single line item, and we break it up over days. So by the end of the first couple of weeks, we will have together gone through and have a general understanding of Governor Inslee's budget and the, you know, kind of the high-level items, certainly.
I know that a big part of writing the budget has to do with the information that lawmakers get from the state's Revenue Council. They come up with a forecast periodically. There will be at least one during the 2025 session. I'm not sure what the timing on it is. It's probably not the greatest timing, but how much do you wait for that information before you make your final decisions?
It's a little tough to forecast the forecast, right? So these are projections. It is a model that is used that is never 100% accurate, but it is the best speculation. It is the best prediction of what we're going to get. And there is a very time-honored economic model that the Economic and Revenue Forecast Council uses. The director of the Economic and Revenue Forecast Council is also referred to as the state economist. So these are PhD economists. We have a relatively new gentleman that's in that role. He had previously been, I believe, either Seattle or King County's economist. And now he came to the state, and he's been with us for a little bit more than a year. We have four of those forecasts per year. They come about a month before the budgets come out, and depending on how long the session is, that will vary either February or March. I believe March 20th of 2025 is the next one we will get. We are required by law to write this upcoming biennial budget with that forecast in mind. So if it projects this amount of revenue, and we've been thinking there was going to be more, and we've been writing a budget to have more spending in it, and it turns out that it is less, then we're going to have to make reductions in a very short period of time. I think we have maybe 2 days from the time the forecast comes out until the time we have to pencils down, we're done, staff has to write the budget if we're going to release it on Monday and we're going to get out on time. So it is a nerve-wracking time that we're always hopeful we'll get a more favorable forecast than what we were hoping. But I've been here in unpredictable years when there have had to be very late reductions in spending in order to hit that mark. And it is not a soft mark. It is a hard mark. It is, you cannot go below this.
You just used a phrase, if we're going to get out of here on time, that we know already, even though session has not started yet, by the time you get halfway through the coming 105-day session, you're going to be hearing this question a lot from reporters. I'll be the first person to ask you that. Here it is, 3 days before the session really opens, but I'll go ahead and ask you, are we going to get out of here on time, Tim?
It is always our intention to start that way. Always, always, always. We want to give the public confidence in our process, that it's open and transparent and available, but also that it's effective and efficient. And those things can sometimes be at odds. You can process yourself right past deadlines if you're not careful. So we do need to have an open and available process, a transparent one that is accountable to the public. But we also need to hit our marks, timeline marks, along the way in order to do that. And sometimes those can be at odds and create some tension. And it turns out it's not unusual that the budget, not always, but that the state operating budget is the main sticking point to not getting concluded on time. There have been other issues in the past. Water was an issue 1 year. Workers' compensation has been an issue in past years. Just depends on what is the hot topic that is there's quite a bit of tension over that needs reconciled. And again, it isn't just the House reconciling that. Is the House and Senate together. And when you have split majorities, say a Republican Senate and a Democratic House or vice versa, that can add to the dynamic and our ability to conclude on time. But it is our intention to get done on time. But I will say this. In the past, we haven't always gotten done on the scheduled date of sine die when the chambers are supposed to adjourn. And when we haven't, it was for good reason. There were still problems to solve that were not resolved yet. And we will only go into special session when it is necessary based on we know we're going to be able to get there. We're not there yet. Let's keep our shoulder to the wheel and grind forward.
I wish you the best on that, if for no other reason than to be able to avoid answering the question of why did you go into special session. And I will point out that since the Democrats have been in charge of both chambers, there hasn't been a special session. And they were fairly common for a long time, sometimes 2, 3, 4 special sessions in a given year. There have been times it went on way into the summer. I don't think anybody expects that with the Democrats in charge because it's been a pretty efficient setup. Talking about the budget being a moral document, yes. You are the chair of the House Appropriations Committee. You sought that job, I suspect, for a reason. And I want to know, what is your view of the budget as a moral document?
It is a public statement of our values. It is hundreds of pages, maybe 2,000 pages. It's got a lot of words in it. It's got a lot of numbers in it, but they mean something. They mean something. It's not just words and numbers and arithmetic and subtraction and addition. It is a reflection of how we interpret our responsibility to the people that live here, how that we see them. We understand the challenges that they're going through. And this moral document, this statement of our values, is reacting to what we're seeing going on out there, to what we're seeing going on with people. And it has always been our practice to lead with our values. We wear that on our sleeve, and we go about the business of trying to create this moral document with our values in mind. And we know that those people that have those needs, they're our responsibility. They're our constituents. They're our residents. They are who we answer to. And they cannot be accurately reflected in a pie chart or a bar graph or a trend line. We have to know what individuals need and translate those needs into this document of words and numbers that directs state government to address those needs.
With a couple of days left here, in which I will sort of sarcastically say you've got a little free time, I will ask you at this point, before I let you go, anything else?
I really think that the Appropriations Committee, more than anything else, is a real reflection of the diversity of the state. We have 30-some members, nearly a third of the entire House of Representatives on the committee. And for as diverse of a group as it is from every corner of the state, I have a very good sense of their integrity. I don't know that that is something that is a tidbit for a news story or anything, but there is good respect and dignity that is demonstrated towards each other. In fact, I insist on it. So we have committee decorum, and we want to model good behavior. We are the largest public-facing House of Representatives committee. And to the extent that we are modeling good behavior, hopefully that is an indication of our deep sense of responsibility to the public.
And now it's time for me to say, Representative Tim Ormsby, Chair Tim Ormsby, my friend Tim Ormsby, I really appreciate you helping us kick off the 17th season of Capital Ideas.
Thank you for having me, Dan. I always look forward to your invitations and always look forward to having a conversation with you.
We'll be back.
Thank you.
And there you have episode 2501 of Capital Ideas. We'll have 2502 up in a few days, and I hope you'll keep listening. This is your state government, and what happens here matters, now maybe more than ever. If you haven't subscribed to Capital Ideas, you can do so on the major podcast sites or just visit the caucus webpage at housedemocrats.wa.gov and hit that media button up at the top of the page. From there, it's a piece of cake. I'm Dan Frizzell for the Washington State House Democrats, putting people first since 1889, the first year you could legally drive a car through Central Park in New York City. Thanks for listening.